Well, welcome, and thanks for the lovely feast, everyone. You can munch and just help yourself as we go along. I will do the same. Quick review. Remember the basic thread. Projections. Collective unconscious demons. That's what we're working on. So easy to get. Blue is the forest for the trees. What we did last time. We talked about how demons imply creativity because they are a part of ourselves that attacks us and throws us. That energy has got to find another outlet, and creativity is often the outlet. A big thing I felt was this distinction between demons and daimons. We say demons, but the original word was daimon, which did not imply a negative evaluation. We talked about other words for demons, which I think one that's very good is storms. Demons are just storms that come over us. And behind those are powers, just different words. Another point I thought which was really helpful, where we distinguish ourselves a little bit from ego psychology, this need to be honored that we find so much among what we call narcissistic people, she says, isn't necessarily an ego quality, but it's the nature of these inner figures. And their need to be honored really is not so negative if you understand it as a need to find its place in your life and to be recognized.
Can I just say something to that? My sense of that is that it needs to be honored, but doesn't it need to be honored by the person who's projecting it?
Absolutely, yeah.
That they put it out there,
right.
Wanting
adoration.
Thank you. Right. And so what they need to do is honor it with them.
Right.
And that's, I think that's what we're narcissism is about.
Right. Because generally, I think if you hear the Freudians talk, it's like, oh, you should get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is, well, you should integrate the meaning of it, which is there's a part of you that isn't known, and that's the way it's appearing. And if you knew it, you could give it the attention you're asking everybody else to give it.
But if you call someone a narcissist, you may not get to the rest of the conversation.
Yeah, it's a showstopper, for sure.
Thank you.
And then we got into a discussion of evil, out of 119, and Jane pointed this out. I don't think I'll read through it, but I bet a lot of you would have this book, The Way of All Women. Esther Harding is kind of a classic. And she talks about evil, 284 to 289. And basically, her point, which I find very sound, is underneath our good motivations often lies power. We really think we're helpful or whatever, and there are often maneuvers to control. And that, carried to an extreme, is evil. It's really well written.
It is, and it gives a good example. So you can
Maybe we should look at the example.
Well, I mean, I don't know, but you didn't want to go into that. But I just think it gives good examples of. And I thought the other interesting thing was that in the one example, the woman trying to put power or get power over.
Why don't you review it for us? Do you remember it?
I've slept now too many times. But it was a woman trying to get. Her husband to do something, and it was really her own power,
mm-hmm.
motivation, but it was she if she would recognize that underneath that is a very basic instinct, a human need, an instinct, almost archetypal.
Mm-hmm.
But that it was operating in her unconsciously. But once acknowledged, then if it loses its power over her.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then it can turn into strength.
Or it's like the parent who tries to live out their own life through the child and pressuring the child to be what they should have.
Exactly. Yeah. What was that movie? The Dead Poets Society.
Yeah.
Classic, yeah. And I think often what's so tricky is that it manifests under caring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where we stopped. We only have a few pages to go, and then we get into happy stuff. But what's so important, I think, about the negative is the things you build of value can never be stronger than your own awareness of your own shadow. So that's why it's not really negative to talk about negative stuff. That's got to be the foundation, an awareness of your own shadow. Bottom 119, she refers to Jung distinguishing between objective evil and subjective evil. It's a hard distinction to make.
Your answer, what page is that?
119. Because they don't really look any different. But you might say, to take a German in Germany during the Hitler period, that evil swept the nation and took people up with it. So to say to yourself, what's this evil in me would lead to demoralization. Rather, saying there is an evil afoot, I have to distinguish myself from it, is the way to stay free from living it out.
So the subjective would be the first thing he says.
No, I was referring. I can't forget what I did say.
You're saying the evil is just in me, I guess.
If you took it personally, then you're demoralized.
Then you're demoralized.
That's subjective.
That's objective.
Oh, that's objective.
Well, let me restate it. Let's say the Nazi evil swept a nation. That's objective evil, because it hit so many people, and it caught them up in its service. That's objective evil. And to say to yourself, I am responsible for this evil, would lead to demoralization. What you're responsible for is not living it out. Where subjective evil would be, I know, say an alcoholic who beats their kids or something, that's evil. That's a subjective evil. They have to take responsibility. That evil is in them.
Like the guy in the Penn State.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, he's saying, I didn't do it, right?
Yeah.
All the evidence is to the contrary. That's personal, subjective evil. But that he is responsible for.
I think, for me, just in terms of language, sometimes I can say, that I'm responsible for the things that are personal, and then I'm responsible to the things that are not.
That's a good way to put it, yeah.
So it's not like I don't have responsibility, but I can't take them on as my own. And
right.
I try to differentiate that, I think, is really kind of
very good point. Yeah.
Challenging. But
responsibility is still in there, it's just, it's a slight difference in attitude towards it.
it makes a big difference, I think, in like not getting completely bogged down by
yeah.
it. And like you said, getting demoralized by it.
Remember, some of you heard this dream of Victor the Russian. I don't know if you heard that Victor the Russian dream. Everyone's heard it. I guess Barbara hasn't. In the dream, Victor the Russian comes up to this guy, and Victor the Russian is clearly evil. And this is before the fall of the Iron Curtain. And he has a potion he wants the dreamer to take and drink. And in the dreamer knows this is how Victor the Russian incarnates himself every couple of generations. He has a drink, he gives it to somebody, they drink it, and they turn into Victor the Russian. So, just as an aside, I mean, that shows how evil works. One person does an evil thing to another person, and then they become evil. Well, in the dream, the dreamer is smart enough to know this is how it works. So he said, no, I'm not taking the poison. And he turned into Victor the Russian anyway. And it was not a client of mine, it was a client of a friend. And what I felt was an issue was, there was child abuse in this person's past. We should take the drink, but we shouldn't drink it. And to take the drink would be to say, I acknowledge evil happened. To not drink it is to say, and I'm not the cause of it. That's the difference. You know, the first thing, if you work with kids, say, who have been abused, first thing they say is, it's my fault. That you say, it's not my fault, but it happened. And that's where, if, say, with Sandusky, he's got to say, it was my fault. That's the difference between objective evil and subjective.
So the guy that became Victor Ruckin, did he do something evil then?
No, no. Actually, he was a professor of theology and quit his job and bought a sheep farm. Now he makes cheese.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That was interesting. The other detail, which is so interesting just from my Jungian point of view, was the dream was dreamt by an analysand of a colleague 20 years prior to my colleague and this fellow working together. It was dreamt during an earlier non-Jungian therapy. And in the dream, someone gives the dreamer a sedative so he will not be so upset about it. And I felt that's what humanistic psychology does. It minimizes the suffering and tries to assuage and comfort. But what really is needed is consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've since met the dreamer. He's a wonderful guy.
Didn't we say early on that one of the qualities of evil is that it always tries to perpetuate itself?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's just it. And there's a great temptation to say, well, I'm doing this because what was done to me. And the dream says, no, you're responsible for what happens. And that's 119. And then she refers to evil as being the aspect of the God image. And, oh yeah, in the dream, Victor the Russian was 2,000 years old.
Wow.
So, see, that's the shadow of the God image. That God image is 2,000 years old. You read this stuff in Jung and you think, where does that come from? But you see dreams like that and you realize that it comes out of that sort of unconscious phenomenology. I think. And then the last part of that chapter is, the destructive aspect of gossip.
Where are you?
Bottom, second paragraph of 120. venomous or rancorous speech strikes others like arrows.
He's also talked about evil hiding behind idealism.
Idealism, very important.
Any kind of doctrine or ism.
Right.
And that means that there's always a shadow side, too.
Right.
religion.
Right.
Right. Did you say assimilation of evil is then the acknowledging and not drinking the poison, but saying, I'm not going to perpetuate it?
Yes. Right. It happened, but I'm not going to take blame that it happened to me. You know, if I go out speeding and I get a ticket, I need to take blame that I caused that bad thing to happen. But, well, let's say the guy was shot on the Mona Trail. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't say he deserved that or he had anything to do with causing that. I mean, there are psychologists around that would say, you draw these bad experiences to you. You may sometimes, but other times it's just, the universe is absurd. And that, the art of staying free of becoming Victor the Russian is saying, that was just a random event. It's a very fine line, whether you say, what's my culpability here, or I have no culpability for this happening. It's the difference between grandiose and guiltiose. Guiltiose would be saying, oh, you know, I deserve that.
Like that guy that you mentioned who was in the concentration camp. And he said, I've never seen such pure evil. But he didn't end up being cynical or something like that.
Is that Wiesel, maybe?
Or Viktor Frankl?
Viktor Frankl, maybe?
That might be
maybe both of them?
Would that be an example of him assimilating evil but not making it subjective?
Yeah. I wouldn't even say assimilate, of him recognizing evil and not become poisoned by it. Like Wiesel tells that they had
a mock trial
yeah. and put God on trial and they declared him guilty. You know what I mean?
But then prayed afterwards.
Yeah. I'm not guilty, but God is. Yeah.
Well, that was
past. Mm-hmm.
What was that?
Elie Wiesel. He's a concentration camp survivor.
Right. Yeah.
He's written plays, novels. Teaches, I think, in Boston. Very active in human rights issues.
I think it's important not to underestimate the power of consciousness to hold something as in terms of containing it, you know, and preventing the spread of evil. You know, it seems in some ways so little or absurd in the face of, like, Nazism, but I think that's the only thing that can make a difference is, you know, how to hold it and sort of contain it, you know, personally, and then, you know, hopefully that will spread culturally so that it doesn't contaminate other things, because you can't, you know, get rid of it. It's in all of us.
Yeah.
The power of consciousness.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good distinction.
Well, that's the end of evil.
Easy for you to
say. Or maybe it was a chapter on evil. I was just.
Yeah.
Well, the next chapter is a little more uplifting. The great mediating demon. So what we'll do now for several chapters is look at positive demons. Or remember better, daimons. And she starts off, not all demons were regarded as evil. We've already said that. Um, 123, reminding us that Christianity brought in the distinction between daimons and demons. And in a way, this is one of these ironies of development, that in its time, that was a positive step of the ego beginning to assess morally what's going on inside of it. You look at the Greek gods, no one ever bothered to say Zeus as it was an SOB. Mm-hmm. It just, there's no moral judgment. And what Christianity brought along with it was moral judgment, which was good for the time, but it's gotten out of control, and now we need to go back and reevaluate some of those assumptions. One of them being that these daimons don't have to work negatively if we can bring consciousness to them. And actually, often the most positive psychological development becomes possible when and after, and maybe only if, we've endured a storm from one of them. So it's always an irony. I just like what she says about the shadow and the second paragraph, a good definition of the shadow. Consists largely of laziness, greed, envy, jealousy, the desire for prestige, aggressions, and similar tormenting spirits.
That's the negative aspect. There can be a positive shadow as well.
Yeah, if you can transform it.
Okay. Would that be under the tormenting spirits? The positive shadow could be they are creative.
Yeah. I think it generally starts as negative. But the goal is to transform it. And how do you begin to work with that? As she says, a couple lines up from that, catch oneself in flagranti, in the very act of doing or saying just the thing. So that's, in a way, contradicting everything I just said about objective evil and subjective evil, you got to say, that was my laziness, that was my greed, that was my envy, that was my jealousy, that's my desire for prestige. I think that's the big one today. PPFF, power, prestige, fame, and fortune. And say, and I'm going to do better. It's really, in the end, a moral shift. And I think that's why Jungian analysis only works with people who are capable of morality, which, believe me, is getting something more questionable, because it just seems that the question of conscience almost doesn't exist anymore. But we do really presuppose the person can say, yeah, I messed up, I'm sorry, I'm going to make an effort to change that. It's pure willpower. Now,
there's a nice little Mary Oliver.
Yes, let's hear it.
About the shadow. She says, it's called When the Roses Speak, I Pay Attention. They said, the roses speak, I pay attention. She says, while we can be extravagant, we will be hugely and amply extravagant. Then we will drop foil by foil to the ground. Such is our unalterable duty, and we do it joyfully. Then they went on. The heart shackles are not as you think. Death, illness, pain, not unrequited hope, not loneliness, but lassitude, rue, vainglory, fear, anxiety, selfishness. The fragrance all the while rising from their blind bodies, making me spin with joy.
She's a genius. And you see how creativity starts in that dark stuff, mm-hmm. and yet it doesn't stay there.
Yeah. And all her poems have, she calls herself a poet of praise, but she
calls herself a poet of praise?
Yes.
Wow.
All her poems have that sort of uplifting quality, but she doesn't ignore the shadow.
It's not sentimental. That's the difference.
There's no sentimentality, and she sees things how they are. She writes poems about death and all kinds of difficult things. Actually, some of her greatest poems are about death, and they're all very uplifting. Mm-hmm. She's got that, you can tell she's grappled with her emotions.
Mm-hmm. So that, in a way, is a link back to what we've just gone through with the negative demons. Now, this chapter is about the anima and the animus. And in a way, a lot of it's standard Jung, but I don't think it will hurt us to hear it. Again, some of you probably know this. So I'll just try to pick out the main points. The shadow is... Well, I think she's a little optimistic. I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. Where is it? She said it here.
There's animus in the second paragraph.
Yeah. I guess somewhere she says, maybe it's not here, but the shadow is relatively easy to integrate. I would add, ha, ha, ha.
Relatively.
Relatively. Underline. But the anima and the animus are enormous tasks and challenges with an enormous benefit that can follow. Look sort of like 6 lines down.
On 123.
Yeah. Right. From the third paragraph, go down 5 lines down. The anima and animus as the real projection creating factors of the psyche. What's different? Well, generally, they are experienced positively. Where the shadow is experienced negatively. Well, you're less inclined to think about what feels good than you are about what feels bad. I think that's one reason that they're so difficult to work with. And they give life its savor. Why would you want to take away the experiences of life to give it savor? Well, why? Because you don't see that the savor is act one, and act two is very often a catastrophe. So one is really fighting just the natural joy to live in working with these things.
You were saying about trying to integrate the anima. Animus, isn't it just to get a better relationship?
Yeah, you really can't integrate it. The idea is, let me back up. Maybe I should give you a definition, which she doesn't really do. Jung defines it in two ways. Some of you heard this. Bear with me. One, it's the personification of the contrasexual aspect of the unconscious. So it's just, if you're a woman, your masculine qualities. If you're a man, your feminine qualities. Part of the problem with this has changed so much since Jung wrote. And I like the way that, actually, Jung's grandson explained it to me, that he thought Jung would have rephrased it by saying, they're really pretty much the same thing, with a slight difference of emphasis. Because women aren't Doris Days anymore, and men aren't John Waynes. That isn't an ideal we live by, but it was even in Jung's time. So, just to realize that there's some cultural relativity here. And what I'm doing now is I'm talking to you. This is another distinction we have to make about the content of the anima and the animus. Let me give you the second definition, and I'll talk about what I mean. The second definition is a personification of the relation to the unconscious. That's hard to grasp. What he means by that is when it is time for you to integrate another quality of your personality, the anima or animus will pick that up and will throw that out into the world as an erotic projection. So that eros is really shaped by the next step of your individuation. Or at least it's shaped to some extent by the next step in your individuation. So that the anima and animus are a process whereby the unconscious turns into erotic projections. It may be an absolutely non-erotic content, but the language the psyche uses is erotic to symbolize it. And so, in the deepest sense, the anima is, an animus is that process that continually weaves a fascination for you in the outer world, which is a message about where you're going in life.
And it's not necessarily a positive fascination, is that right? I mean, could it be something difficult?
Yes, but I think if there is a extreme negative reaction, often that is just ready to turn into a positive one. It's very tricky, but I would say the way I'm presenting it is a little simplistic, but just to give you a sort of a rule of thumb idea, where there's a great resentment, there's probably a hidden longing. Otherwise, you wouldn't bother with it. You wouldn't care. So that you might say what the anima and animus does, it rivets you to something.
Yes.
Of a erotic nature.
Did you talk about, so in say, gay, so women, gay women, then...
I don't think it makes any difference, but it does force us, I believe, to expand our grasp of how the psyche works. I would say that the deeper point to the anima and animus is that eros is teleological. And that's the real point. For a man and a woman who are heterosexual, that eros is going to operate through the opposite sex figures. For a gay person, it's going to operate through the same sex figures. But I think it's the same dynamic. And where we are, what we are in danger of doing is arguing about categories of labels, which are just things we invent anyway. But I think the deeper point is that eros is purposive. So for a gay person, that erotic projection will come up for the same sex, for heterosexual, for the opposite sex. Well, the point I was trying to get at about this bit about integration, that process will never stop. You can't integrate that process and it'll go away. It's always going to continue. What you integrate are those contents that it seizes on and projects. That can be integrated. So to be pure about it, I should say, you can integrate the contents of the anima and animus, but you can never integrate the anima and animus. Because the anima and animus is just a word for that process which Jung, I would say, discovered, whereby psychic growth, that is integration of psychological contents, proceeds by way of erotic projection.
So there are autonomous factors in the psyche, and
the animus are
autonomous.
Completely autonomous. And it will always remain so.
And they're really kind of a bridge, so they go back and forth between the and the ego.
That's what I've just said is okay. Can be expressed in another language as the anima and animus is a bridge.
Okay.
The way to put that is your outer experience is a reflection of your inner world.
And then, so the way you treat your unconscious, no, how's that, the way you treat your animus is the way your unconscious treats you?
Oh, the way you treat your unconscious is the way it treats you.
Yeah.
So if you are constantly devaluing anything that's emotional or heartfelt as opposed to reason, the more you do that, the more the unconscious turns negative. And the more then it will snare you into relationships rather than guide you into them. But, let's face it, no one's ever going to solve this. Maybe very realized people do, but actually I have no desire to be that realized. I kind of like the mess.
And a lot of, I mean, enlightened people have done tremendous harm, you know, I guess, you know, realized people. I mean, there's been, you know, many Buddhist masters that, I think it was the guy that was the head of the ashram out on the East Coast that got HIV from being promiscuous and contaminated many people with HIV, and this is an enlightened master. You know, so I'm not sure, you know, maybe it does happen, but certainly people that are said to be realized have done great harm, so I think that there may remain an aspect of humanity that, I mean, again, maybe there are a few people that are not like that, like Buddha, I don't know, I mean, didn't meet or meet the man, but certainly the, you know, communities that we're aware of that are allegedly enlightened still have a shadow side of, that they may be actually very blind to because of thinking they've got their shit all
right. I think it's partly cultural. I don't see how you can live in the West and not engage in its demands. You have a mortgage to pay. You know, you have maybe, unless you're a single, kids to put through college. These demands don't approach people living on a mountaintop in Tibet, which I hardly admire and support. It's just, it's a different situation. That may be how it works.
Although when you're an ashram, all this shit happens exactly the same. I mean, the same shit happens there.
Does it?
Absolutely. It's just one big dysfunctional family. You know, you can't escape. You know, like, it absolutely, totally happens. People have the same reactions and the same projections. Everything is the same. They just put, like, a little sort of glossy, you know, surface over the top, you know. So it is no different.
I'm just trying to hold on to the...
It could be worse, because they might... You know, some might be attracted to that because of the denial of shadow stuff.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So people all walk around wearing white and pretending to be gay, and everybody's, you know, fucking each other and, you know, being evil on a petty level, just like we all do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the same. Yeah. But there's no escape.
I know in the Peace Corps, my language teacher, a young woman, said, when somebody grabs my butt, he's wearing an orange robe. Although I'm trying to hold on to the illusion that Dalai Lama isn't a pervert, so.
Yeah. And he's not unaware of his own shadow.
Maybe that's it.
And he's spoken about, like, his rage when, you know, the Bush response to 9/11. He said it took him days to get past being enraged, and he knew that wasn't the thing that was going to be helpful, but he doesn't deny that he's got it.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's
that may be
key.
It.
Like, he's not unaware of his own shadow, and I think that's what makes the difference. You know, he doesn't pretend like, oh, I'm better than that, and I don't feel rage like all you petty, miserable people. He's like, I was, you know, he was so angry.
That's beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's the helpful part there.
Okay.
Just one thing, that always, I think there always something, when you say the contents of these.
Right.
That when Emma Young did that book on the Anam,
Animus, beautiful book.
Yeah, I think that you know, standing up in a taller, I mean, trying to look at it from a higher viewpoint, or the progression of physical. You're attracted to physical men, or men because their body is nice to look at. And then you're attracted to a man with who are doing deeds.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could just say any deeds, but then you're attracted to ones who do more meaningful deeds. And words, I mean, you know, for myself, words, guys who can use words.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, then you can see through the tricks and the deceptions, and then you get to the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
A person who is really looking for meaning, or finding the meaning, and the truth. And so I think that Delaney, she kind of made that progression, I think, that helps outline, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah. It does seem to evolve.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a sort of directedness to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just be clear when you say erotic, that's the traditional meaning of erotic.
What is a traditional?
No, I mean, that's what's not just the traditional.
Yeah, sexual attraction.
That's not
it. Though it doesn't have to be, it's hard to say. The difference between eros and sex. They're darn close, but I think you can have eros without sex, but you can't have, well, you can have sex without eros, obviously. But It's, but still, there's a feeling, well, we're not going to be having an affair, but we could. And there's something here beyond the physical that is attracting me to you as a guy anyway, as a woman. It does something to your heart. But basically, you can say a sexual attraction. Mm-hmm. Realizing there's a difference between just fucking somebody and being enamored and moved by their being. Yeah.
It does animate you.
Yes.
Something gets animated in you.
That's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah.
What animates you? Emotionally. Yeah. It's really weird. This, I don't know if this will help you or not, but where I really figured out what the animal was, I was teaching English as a foreign language in Switzerland, at Swissair. And students were 18 to 22. I was 28. And we had to give language exams, so at the end of the year. So a Scottish friend, or colleague really, he taught in another school, but they paired us up. We're giving language exams. And this one woman walked in, and I thought, holy shit, I never realized you were so beautiful. So she sat down, and what do you think happened? He and I started talking to each other. See what I mean? It wasn't that we were trying to make contact with her. She somehow gave us the inspiration to talk to each other. That's what the animal is. Yeah. So it's that enlivening, an enlivening desire to make contact with life. Okay, that's 123. How are we doing? Do we have a stretch?
Three pages.
Have a little munch and then we'll pick up.